RadioInfluence.com.
Welcome to the Tennis with an Accent podcast. I am Matt Zemek, along with my partner, Saqib Ali. And during this week, we have the ATP Finals going on in London. But as is generally our practice here at Tennis with an Accent, we don't really talk about ongoing tournaments because this is a once per week podcast. So if you're listening to us on Thursday or Friday, and we record this episode early in the week, you know, our thoughts might be a little bit outdated. So we try to talk about something other than the in-progress tournament that's going on. Now, there will be exceptions to this podcast, like when we broadcast during a major tournament. Yeah, we'll try and do a special podcast on a really special or important match that just happened. But we will be reviewing the ATP Finals and the ATP season later in November. So this week, we wanted to focus on a couple of big stories in the tennis world while you watch what's going on in London. And one of the stories is that Darren Cahill, the excellent tennis analyst and commentator for ESPN, also the coach who brought Leighton Hewitt and Andre Agassi considerable riches at different points in their career, he stepped away from his coaching relationship with Simona Halep to spend more time with his family and find that life-work balance, which all of us, no matter what our profession, need to be able to get right so that our lives never lose equilibrium and that we can all pursue the things that we want to without being overstretched. So Cahill felt that he needed to achieve some balance there, and that is undeniably a topic that we want to hit on. So Saqib, as we start with the Cahill-Halep relationship, give your overall assessment about what it produced, what it didn't produce. There are many ways to critique this particular coach-player relationship. What are your foremost observations?
Matt, I want to start with what I really, along with many tennis fans, echo in your sentiment on an excellent piece that he wrote for TennisAccent.com about how Cahill evolved as a coach with for the last 15 to 18 years. And he had like three excellent charges from Andre Agassi, Leighton Hewitt, and now Simona Halep. And each one of them had their own date with destiny, and how these great players, you know, along with Darren Cahill, you know, set on that journey and went on to achieve some wonderful goals. And even as my journey as a tennis fan, Darren Cahill is someone who I've been listening to, I'm sure same for you, on ESPN. And his analysis, you know, you always walked away that you learned something more. And again, we've talked about at length, even in our Tennis with an Accent, you know, written format, that a lot of times there's a mainstream coverage from these big networks like ESPN, where a diehard tennis fan sometimes, you know, gets shortchanged because the stars are being the focus. But with Cahill, you never got that. And that was an extension, I'm sure, what he did in the coaching world, because his work with Agassi was very well documented. I think that cemented his worth with a network like ESPN, and this secured him right away when Agassi retired. And now talking about Simona Halep, I mean, this is a partnership, I believe. Cahill used to work through Adidas program with a lot of players, and Simona is an Adidas player. So I don't know how it started, but I always thought it was a part-time arrangement. But then you start paying attention and they, you know, turn this thing into a full-time partnership. And this is a partnership where I always felt Simona gave the coach his due, and he was equal in calling some of the shots, how this partnership played out. And there was this incident in Miami last year, which is very well documented, even pointed out on several occasions by you, when there was a lack of effort and Cahill just, you know, told Simona Halep, you know, let's reevaluate this, and I don't need to rush to a judgment kind of a decision. But, you know, if you're not going to be into this 100%, or if you're going to have an off day, or you aren't committed as a champion that, you know, we thought you would be. And, you know, and that was a turning point. And then she played in the French Open final, you know, 7-8 weeks from then, lost to Ostapenko. And a year later, she was victorious. So again, Darren Cahill, like you mentioned, and if you want to share some of the insights from the piece, I think, you know, he just has a great complete across the two tours report card now from the likes of Hewitt, who was a breakout player in 2001, Agassi, who was, you know, trying to reset his twilight years, and he became world number one with his, you know, run with Cahill, and then Simona Halep, you know, reaching a monumental task of winning a slam, because she was already, till this French Open, the best player who has not won a major. So again, when a coach comes into these kind of roles, there's a lot of tennis, there's a lot of, you know, man or woman management, how you manage your player, how you get to know them. And he seems like he's, you know, and he also stays under the radar, you know, like he's a superstar coach, but he's a superstar coach because he's a coach who has credentials to be superstar. He, unlike the Becker Edbergs of the world, who were like world beaters and they came in with such a huge resume. So over to you, and you know, why you did some great comparisons with some of the NBA coaches, of people who have already read the piece, and just, you know, walk me through, and even the listeners, why those comparisons made sense to you, especially from the basketball spectrum.
Yeah, so let me start out by explaining that piece at tennisaccent.com on Darren Cahill. I compared him most centrally to Greg Popovich, the head coach of the NBA's San Antonio Spurs. And I've started out my piece by saying that when I compare tennis coaches to coaches in other sports, basketball is the easiest one, because baseball and American style football and even ice hockey, those sports involve larger rosters, and they involve a lot more interventions from the coach into the flow of a game. Like the way a baseball manager handles a pitching staff, that is very hands-on, and it leaves a very large imprint on a game. But basketball is a little bit different from those other three sports in that there are just five men on a team, or at least on a court at one time, and the roster, usually in the playoffs, a coach will usually use only like 8 or 9 players. So it's a very small group, and you need 1 or 2 superstars to be at their very best, and then you form a supporting cast around those 1 or 2 really great players. So in basketball, there is an intimacy between a coach and a star player. And you think through not just recent examples such as, you know, Phil Jackson with Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, but think about 50 years ago with Red Auerbach and Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics. You know, for every great coach, there's a great player that he bonded with, and that one-on-one coach-player relationship in basketball formed the nucleus of a very successful NBA championship team. So that's why basketball and tennis have this intimacy in terms of individual coach-player relationships that really doesn't translate quite as much in the other sports. And so now to make the transition to my Cahill-Popovich comparison, when you look at Hewitt when he won the 2001 U.S. Open under Cahill, Agassi when he won the 2003 Australian Open under Cahill, and then Simona Halep when she won the 2018 Roland Garros title under Cahill, you have not just three athletes, and not just in the two different tours, WTA and ATP, but you have players who won major titles under Cahill at three very different points in their careers. Hewitt won his U.S. Open under Cahill at age 20. Halep won her Roland Garros title at age 26, and Agassi was almost 33. So you really have neatly spaced out careers, roughly 6 years apart, spanning ages 20 to 32, to be able to reach athletes at the highest level and succeed with them at those three very different periods in an athlete's evolution and understanding of a game. That's rather remarkable. You will not find many other tennis coaches who have that knack to reach a young athlete, a mid-career athlete, and an athlete in the final years of his career, as Agassi was. So when you compare that to Popovich, you know, he did have a great, great player, Tim Duncan, who many regard as the best power forward ever to play professional basketball. But the way in which Duncan was a superstar was very different from the way that other players, such as Kobe and Michael, and also Shaquille O'Neal, another guy who Phil Jackson coached. Duncan was a very different kind of superstar in that he was the selfless superstar. He's not the guy who insisted on taking every shot. He's not the guy who insisted on taking over a game. He's the guy who blended in with teammates, was happy to do the grunt work, the not so glorious things, so that other players such as Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili on those great San Antonio Spurs teams would have the freedom to do what they needed to do. So Popovich showed an elasticity in his style, which calls to mind Cahill's ability to move between the WTA and ATP tours, and to move between coaching a young athlete such as Hewitt and an old athlete such as Agassi, and then a mid-career athlete such as Halep. He moved, Cahill did, so seamlessly among those three athletes. And so in that, I find a lot of Popovich's skills. Popovich won his first NBA title in 1999 with the Spurs, and he won his fifth and at least so far his last one in 2014, 15 years apart. So that shows his ability to adjust to the professional basketball world and all of its changes over a long period of time. With Cahill, you have his first major as a coach in Hewitt in 2001 with Hewitt, and then you have his third major with Halep 17 years later in 2018. So that also shows a similar level of adaptability. So when you go through all of these comparisons, you know, it might seem hyperbolic to compare Cahill to Greg Popovich, one of the greatest basketball coaches ever. But I think that Cahill, while he doesn't have, you know, the truckload of major titles that a Tony Nadal or Marion Vida has, still in his own way and on his own level, his legacy as a tennis coach is enormous. And that Halep championship at Roland Garros this year really cemented that legacy in many substantial ways.
And Matt, also, I'm sure most tennis fans remember, Cahill had a workout with Roger Federer and his group in Dubai, I believe, in early 2009. And due to, at that time, cited reasons like he has a young family and he that the job would require him to travel, you know, more than 17, 18 weeks a year. And, they agreed that, you know, this arrangement would not work. And, you know, not many people would walk away from coaching Roger Federer. And on a personal note, you know, I always think what could have happened had Cahill, as the plan was in 2002 after Hewitt, was supposed to coach Murat Safin. But then Andre Agassi, I guess, you know, was more interested, and he convinced Aaron Cahill to, you know, work with him. And that's legendary, you know, how that alliance turned out. But yeah, I mean, definitely you pointed out some, you know, very interesting points with the Popovich comparison, as not only Cahill, you know, delivered with these respective players. I believe even as a coach, he grew, because what he learned from Hewitt and then what he learned from Agassi and that phase. And then he was, you know, in the booth and in the interim, I used to hear that he's working with the Adidas program in Vegas with guys like Verdasco, Gulbis, even Sania Mirza. He was always as an on-site consultant, I think, through the Adidas program. And then he came back full-fledged and, you know, helped Simona Halep get over the hump. And I honestly think he's taken a year sabbatical, so this is not something that's done and dusted. Maybe they come back and renew this because, you know, Magnus Norman was convinced by Stan Wawrinka, who also cited similar reasons to spend time with his young family, and guess what? He was back. So this is more cordial, and I think maybe the door's not, you know, shut. Maybe we can see Simona and Cahill back at some point.
Yeah, absolutely, Saqib. That comparison to Magnus Norman is particularly excellent. I want to add one note about Cahill, not along the Popovich line or that particular comparison, but just in relationship to what you mentioned earlier about the moment he had with Halep when, you know, he said, you know, this is up to you, Simona, to figure out. You have to decide for yourself, you know, what matters and if you want to be coached. And there's a lot of power in that, and there's a lot of meaning in that. You know, this podcast is produced by Radio Influence, and one of the various other members of the Radio Influence family of podcasts that we sometimes share on social media is the Jim Fannin Show. And Jim Fannin, for people who aren't familiar with the name, and the last name is spelled F-A-N-N-I-N. Jim Fannin was once the coach of one of the great doubles players of his time, Peter Fleming, the partner for John McEnroe, who won several Grand Slam doubles titles from the late 1970s through the early to mid 1980s. And so Jim Fannin does a lot of coaching, life coaching, you could say, not just tennis coaching. And so part of the art of coaching, and I'm sure Jim would agree with this, is that you have to have the security in your mind and in your approach that you do not depend on the player's response to validate your philosophy. So what does that mean? That might seem a little bit murky or esoteric. When I talk about having the security to not worry about what a player says or what someone else responds to when you coach that person, what I mean is this. Cahill did not care what Halep did, in the sense that if she was going to, you know, ditch the relationship, end the relationship, Cahill was being true to what he was advocating. He was being true to what he was teaching. And if you really are committed to what you teach, Saqib, you're going to stick by that no matter what. If you really believe in what you're trying to do and you arrive at a moment of difficulty with a person that you're coaching, with a person you're trying to improve, there comes a point where you can do all the coaching you want, but it's up to that other person to accept that coaching. And so Cahill was willing to risk that coaching relationship. In other words, he didn't value keeping that paycheck, you know, keeping that share of Halep's prize money. He didn't value that over everything else. He was willing to give that up because he trusted his philosophy and he trusted his approach. If Halep was going to walk away, so be it. Cahill would have slept well at night. But because he had built up enough trust with Halep, trust that she would, you know, stick to his approach and continue to buy into what he was saying, because he had that trust, because he had that security, he was able to challenge Halep like that. And it's from that challenge, from that moment of friction, that Halep was able to clear that final hurdle. And, you know, that is how great coach-player relationships work. It's not all sunshine and rainbows. It's not all sweetness and light. When you're on that path to try and win that first major title, or in basketball, to win that first NBA title, you're going to go through bumps. You're going to go through rocky places. I mean, that is the usual way, you know, for someone like Naomi Osaka, you know, or a very young Rafael Nadal, you know, those are the exceptions. But for the most part, you know, you have to walk over the hot coals of doubt and worry and stress and, am I going to do this? And am I capable of doing this? And, you know, so doubt is a very natural and organic thing. It's not as though Halep was doing anything necessarily wrong, but Cahill had built up enough of a relationship where he was free. He was secure within himself to challenge Halep, and Halep, you know, had to look very deeply inside herself to truly know what it is that she wanted. And she eventually became stronger than ever before, backed up her year-end number one accomplishment in 2017 with a replication of that feat in 2018. So it really shows that you have to be sometimes secure enough to risk everything. Cahill was secure enough within himself to risk the dissolution of that partnership, you know, under less happy, less auspicious circumstances. And now he gets to walk away, take this sabbatical, having achieved the ultimate goal that he and Simona both wanted very badly for each other. It's a beautiful story.
It is. And I think Matt very well said. Again, I don't want to, you know, keep agreeing here, but I just want to, you know, echo your sentiment exactly by saying, I think coaching especially, I'm a little old school too. It's a, you know, relationship between, you know, a tutor or a mentor and the charge. So in this way, not that coaching sometimes, you know, gets shortchanged in this new era of sports and, you know, team sports, where player is the entity. But at the same time, when you are trying to hire someone or work with someone, I think there's an element of respect, you know, that sometimes has gotten lost. And again, I don't want to sound like a fossil because, you know, this is NBA and even tennis, it's a players' league these days. But yes, I think the security and trust of Darren Cahill came from because he knew that, you know, he could add value if Simona trusts him, you know, by bringing him on her team and embark on this journey where, you know, like sometime you may need to tinker with the mental approach or the or technical side because she was already, you know, a very established player. So this just funnily makes me go back to the story that was on ESPN, I think in 2006, when the legendary American coach Larry Stefanke was working with Fernando Gonzalez. And again, like many off-season coaching relationships, the plan was to work with Andy Murray, but the difference was Stefanke said why he took the Gonzalez job, because Gonzalez called himself and Murray had the agent call. So this is more like the Jerry Sloan, John Stockton, you know, relationship, which you probably are more aware of. But again, these are small things, you know, like old coaches like Stefanke valued that getting a personal call from Fernando Gonzalez himself. And I think similar traction, you know, was you know, the reason why Cahill was so transparent with Simona Halep, and Simona Halep had no inhibitions or any shame, you know, that they were the equals in this partnership, even though she was a superstar player. She wanted him very bad on the team, and I guess that transpired and resulted in the great success that we witnessed.
Absolutely. And, you know, one other thing to say about Halep is that, you know, for a lot of her career, she has been hard on herself. And she, I think most of the time, you know, had such a high standard toward herself that when she didn't meet it, you know, she was her worst critic. And I know that, you know, we need to be our worst critics, you know, because no one can improve ourselves better than we can. You know, in the moment, you know, it's up to us to look within ourselves and do what needs to be done. But like anything else in life, being your worst critic, you know, you can go overboard with that. And so in Cahill, I sensed a very keen understanding of the person he was coaching and showing a certain freedom to, you know, allow Halep to spill out these emotions without judgment, but yet gently calling her, you know, to take ownership for her emotions in ways that would be channeled positively. And so, you know, so much of coaching, when we talk about coaching in sports, it's easy to focus on the game management and the tactics. You know, in America, the NFL, American style football, is the most popular sport, and we always talk about the play calls and the how when you used a timeout and things of that nature. But at its ultimate level, you know, coaching is really about connecting with that athlete on the other side of the relationship. And if you can't connect with the athlete, you know, it doesn't mean that the relationship has to be, you know, a joyful, jocular one, but you have to have that gut level connection. I think of as just one example, Tony Roach and Yvon Lendl. You know, Lendl was a cutthroat player. You know, he was not he did not have exactly a sunny disposition, to put it very charitably. And Roach was from the Australian old school. You know, he would not be called a new age coach by any measurement. So, you know, from Roach came Lendl, and, you know, Roach, of course, led Roger Federer through his prime years extremely well. You know, he helped give stability and structure to Federer. I think one of the defining things that Roach gave to Federer was when he asked Roger, "Are you willing to play 7-5 setters at a major? You know, can you do that? Is your body ready for it?" And when Federer contemplated that question, you know, he realized, "Wow, am I really at that point?" And so that question from Roach really spurred Federer to make sure that he was the fittest man on the court, or at least as fit as he possibly could be. And that certainly played a role in giving Federer's career at that point the stability it needed. And so now we now go to today, where Roche's protege, you know, one of the players that he mentored for so long, Ivan Lendl. Lendl is now that hard, stern coach who enabled Andy Murray to taste ultimate success and is now embarking on the journey with Sasha Zverev. You know, the Lendl Murray partnership. I mean, Lendl drove Murray. You know, that it was not a smooth ride. You know, it was part of a very demanding relationship. But you know, what do we say about the teachers who were very hard on us in grade school or high school? You know, we realized that they were tough on us, but with the passage of time, we realized that our teachers were hard on us because they cared about us and because they saw great potential in us. You know, if we didn't have potential, a teacher might not have focused much on us, might have looked to someone else in the classroom. But we look back on those influencers in our lives, and a number of them were probably harsh with us, but they were harsh from a place of caring. And so in Tony Roach and with Ivan Lendl, you know, you can see that the coaching relationship, there has to be a willingness on the part of the coach, you know, not to be a best friend, but to be that truth teller. And that is one of the great connections one can make with those coaches and with Darren Cahill. That is one of the common thread that knits great coaches together.
No, absolutely. That was, again, you know, good solid comparison, because I watch a lot of tennis, you know, when Lendl was, you know, world number one, and he was, you know, relentless in the pursuit of trying to win at the All England Club. And that's why I believe he got Tony Roche, and that's why he started serving volleying. Maybe, you know, we should do another podcast on just, you know, some of those, you know, old time, you know, tennis stories. But so Cahill and Halep, you know, let's see if we can, you know, see this partnership in the future again. Let's change the conversations here quickly, Matt. There's been few topics that have gained some, you know, momentum while the ATP finals are going on in London. And one of them is Julien Bennett, of the Frenchman, who was on a radio show, I believe, in France, and Roger Federer, and some of the influence the Swiss has on the ATP, according to Julien Bennett, was the topic. Is it something that got lost in translation? Because Federer today spoke to the press and he didn't want to, you know, he took the high road. He said he knows Julien from the, you know, junior days, and he thinks a lot of it was out of context and some of the facts, you know, weren't fully disclosed, but he didn't want to comment too much on it. But let's get your views, especially, you know, as far as the listeners go, what Bennett said, and in a very summarized way, you know, what to make of it. Is it something that we already know has been said, or, you know, most powerful players or more popular players, to be more precise, in any sport get that preference, because a lot of this is a business driven by TV. And if Federer is getting scheduling preferences or not, is it the first or the last time this is happening in any sport?
It's not the first, and it won't be the last. And so the first thing to say about Beneteau's comments is that fundamentally he's accurate. You know, he's right. And moreover, it is proper and appropriate of him to say that this is a problem in tennis. It is a conflict of interest for Tennis Australia and the USTA to have their hands in Labor Cup. You know, that is a crossing of boundaries. It's a reaching across different silos, different realms of operation, which generally should not happen. So that is a problem. And I don't think many, if any, people in tennis think it's not a problem. Where Beneteau's argument runs into a wall, though, and I'm not even saying or suggesting that he's wrong, it's just that there is a contextual limit here. Conflicts of interest are always prevalent in tennis, and they've been prevalent for a very, very long time in terms of various divisions. Such as, you know, who comments on matches for media outlets, you know, like Mary Jo Fernandez commenting on a Federer match, you know, since she's married to Tony Godsick. The tennis conflict of interests are so numerous, it's not really the point that the conflict of interest is a problem. We know that. We know that is commonplace and pervasive in the sport. The real issue we need to get at here is who oversees the overseers, you know, who governs the governors, who is the watchdog for the watchdogs. You know, that is tennis's fundamental problem. I mean, there is no, it is not like the team sports in North America where there's a commissioner, you know, or some elite, some leadership figure who ostensibly can weigh in on a larger situation and gather competing parties together around a bargaining table. There's no commissioner of tennis. There is no one governing body or figure who commands universal respect in terms of like a governing structure or architecture. There is no clear chain of command or line of priority. So tennis has to figure all of those things out before we can say, well, this guy needs to do something about this problem. I mean, you know, obviously in an ideal world, Craig Tiley with Tennis Australia would not be so involved with Laver Cup, or to be more precise, he wouldn't be involved with Laver Cup at all. But who's going to oversee Craig Tiley, and who oversees Tennis Australia? You know, we have, that should be where Julien Benneteau and anyone else upset about this kind of situation should be thinking. Now, you know, Novak Djokovic, you know, tried at least to some extent to see or explore if a tennis players union could be formed at the 2018 Australian Open. You know, I think it's a great idea. I think tennis sorely needs a joint player union to represent the players on both tours. You know, that is something which really has to happen so that players get a much larger share of tournament revenue, tournament money, than they currently do. And hopefully that the players who benefit the most from that would be on the Challenger Tour, so that if you're 150 or 200 in the world, which really isn't that bad, that you can make a living off of that. You can make a good living off of that and hire a coaching staff and a training team that will attend to your needs. And so tennis doesn't just become a winner's tour where the top 10, 20, 30 are the only ones making an especially large amount of money. So Benneteau is right, but to what effect, and where are we taking this conversation? The idea that it's bad and inappropriate for Tennis Australia to be involved in Laver Cup, who disputes that? But who oversees the situation, who makes a ruling on the situation, who governs the situation, who reforms the situation? Those are really the conversations we need to have, and nothing in this larger Benneteau commentary really gets to that point, in my estimation.
Yeah, I think that's a well-known fact. Like, you compared tennis to the North American sports, and, you know, North American sports have, you know, the leagues are known by the acronyms, you know, MLB, NBA, NFL, NHL. Tennis is, you know, first of all, they have two different tours, but then within the tours, there's ITF and then there's a Grand Slam. So, yeah, even folks who follow tennis, like all 46 weeks a year, when there's action going on, even they sometime, you know, look for some guidance, you know, on the leadership, and they're not clear. If your non-tennis friends come to you and ask, hey, what's the difference between, you know, so-and-so and the governing bodies, and why, you know, why is this even a discussion? So you're right. I mean, you know, leadership, will this be, will there ever be like consolidated leadership? The answer is, you know, I don't know if there's a clear answer, because there's so many vested parties, and to have them all under one umbrella would be ideal. But, you know, that's been a discussion for quite a while, and it's really gained some momentum in the last year and a half. And the players union, yeah, that can serve everyone well, especially the players, because like you said, the lower players could be protected. And now Roger Rashid, you know, he was also on, I think, one of the ATP committees. He was let go. So there is some movement. We don't know. Maybe when the players meet again, I know they had a meeting in London. Maybe we'll get to know more when these things, you know, are published in the press. But right now, going back to Benneteau, so one issue that we agree, you know, there should be more transparency and there should be no conflict of interest. But then, you know, that's a lot of people are saying that conflict of interest is part of professional tennis. So it's not the first instance with Craig Tiley and, you know, Tennis Australia and even USTA are, you know, in partnership with Laver Cup. But then again, you know, the other things he said, that Federer is getting preferential treatment. Do you see a direct link there, or do you think Federer is just the most popular player? Like Craig Tiley in Tennis Australia released a statement that, you know, in prime time you want to put the person who's most in demand, and that happens usually in most slams, and Wimbledon is the only one that does their own thing, and a lot of time it's member driven. But let's stick to Australia first, because that's the tournament that's in question.
Yeah, I'd like to start by referencing one of the sports that I've covered longer than I have covered professional tennis, and that is American-style college football. So I know I'm speaking to a global audience. Let me just simplify the context here so it's very simple to understand. In American college sports, which is a billion-dollar business, the players do not get paid. They don't get paychecks. You know, they do get scholarships to go to college, so they get, you know, financial aid to go to school in exchange for being able to play American style football or also basketball. But the coaches recruit these athletes from high school to play at university. And when these players get into, let's say, trouble with the law, they commit some sort of violation, the coaches often make decisions on whether to kick players off the team, which prevents them from being able to play at the school, or they keep the player on the team. They impose some kind of internal discipline, but they still allow the player to play. That is a conflict of interest which has persisted in American collegiate athletics, you know, for a very, very long time. It's kind of similar to the length of time that conflicts of interest have existed in professional tennis. The point I'm making here is that when a coach who is paid to win games is also made into the team's disciplinarian in terms of making Solomonic judgments on whether law-breaking teenage athletes, 18, 19, 20 years old, get to play collegiate sports or not, you know, that is a decision that a college sports coach should not make. It is a decision which should not be in his hands. It should be handled by a combination of law enforcement and non-sports administrators. You know, it's not something the athletic director at an American university should decide. The athletic director is the boss of the coach of the team. It should be something that gets decided by, like, the university president, the provost, you know, these non-sports related administrators at the school, because it's off-field conduct. It represents the university at the highest level. A coach who is paid to win games should never be in a position to make that decision, Saqib. So I say all that to then transfer to tennis, and that is that certain people should not even be in position to make certain decisions. You know, if it should not be the case that Craig Tiley or Tennis Australia, whoever makes the schedules at the Australian Open, you know, always gets to decide who plays on an outdoor court in that searing Australian summer heat and who gets to play under a roof. It shouldn't always fall to the tournament organizers, you know, who gets to play in a night session and who gets to play in a day session. There should be some freedom. There should be some flexibility for tournaments and tournament organizers. But in tennis, we really need to get to a point, to some extent, you know, it's not going to be all at once. It needs to be gradual and incremental, where we take some decisions out of the hands of organizers who are always naturally going to put Federer, in the night session, on the center court, things like that. Now, I'm not saying that we should get to a point where, you know, Federer is always relegated to the outer court. I'm not trying to go there. I'm more trying to get at the idea that, you know, Federer getting preferential treatment, that is the oversold angle here. What we should really be focusing on is why Djokovic, as a primary example, you know, gets banished to an outer court at Wimbledon. You know, why happen?
Let me intervene here. I agree with a lot of things you said, especially the first part where, you know, there could be a conflict of interest. But, you know, I think this is a little also overblown. Granted, you know, like Djokovic has been shortchanged, and I would definitely want to see some equality in there, that Federer is, you know, also, and Murray, when he's back, should see at least court one, if not court two, once in a while. But you know, Wimbledon is very different. Like when Richard Evans was on the podcast last year, he tried to explain it's the old members club. And the membership is very limited because they don't want to give out too many free tickets. And they don't call, you know, Rolex as a sponsor. They call them as a partner. So it's a very different world. It really functions differently. Even the Lord's Cricket Stadium, which they say has moved on with the times at Wimbledon. Of course, we've talked about it many times. This is where fans and even media and people like us, we always compare. But Wimbledon is a very different place. That's what I've been told. Not saying it's right. I'm not glorifying. But they operate differently. And this is a very member-driven. Of course, they have media pressure, you know, with the English press and also ESPN, BBC, and some of the big stakeholders. But they are going more purely by demand of the members. And if Federer and Murray are chosen, you know, it's not the right way. I'm not endorsing it. But I don't think we can club it the way Craig Tiley and co or Katrina Adams and co and these guys work. Because these tournaments have their own agendas, have their own, you know, way of functioning. Like US Open is the most ridiculous when it comes to buying tickets. That's the other aspect of it. You know, the tickets, if Serena is in the tournament, Federer is in the tournament, Nadal and Djokovic are playing the night session, the tickets fluctuate. I know I'm kind of taking it in a very different way, but each tournament has their own way of working. And I think it's still fairly very democratic if you look at this, because when Boris Becker won Wimbledon, he hadn't seen center court till I think he plays Anders Järred. I believe he beat Tim Mayotte on court 13. He beat Joachim Nystrom on court 1. And you know, that's what Andy Roddick said. Sometimes you have to look. It's 7 matches to the trophy. And as long as you're getting 7 matches with new balls and good courts, it's fine. And I understand Federer should go on court 1. I'm not endorsing that. But a lot of times it's overblown. Because when I was in French Open as a fan, I saw Feliciano Lopez arguing with a tournament official when they were walking for practice, because she gave him a practice court where 4 singles players would split one court to practice. And he said, "What? I'm not a singles player, I'm a seed." So he was complaining. And then Ernest Gulbis, a few days later, complained in the press that now as a journeyman or as someone ranked as a qualifier, he was seeing, you know, how the facility is different, how they don't even get same treatment. Top players always get, you know, practice courts at the big venues of the slams. So that's where the tournaments are not democratic. Honestly, you know, this whole match thing is okay. But I think sometimes it just gets too much of an opinion. I think court 1, definitely, Federer and Murray should see that. I'm not saying they have the, you know, they should always play all their matches in center court. But overall, Nadal, Djokovic, all the big names, they really don't go to court 2. That's what I'm trying to say. So I think comparison slightly, I think it's generalizing. Things work very differently at Wimbledon. And when there's a night tournament, a tournament with lights like US Open or Australian Open, yeah, I think it's like Roddick said, you know, it's pretty close to what is, you know, what the tournament can do. Of course, we can always argue what's unfair, what's not fair, and that, you know, that can always be, you know, a point of debate. But overall, I think it's everybody gets a fair shot to win 7 matches in same conditions usually.
You know, I would agree with that. And I just want to emphasize the point here that, you know, let's say that Tennis Australia did not have any sort of relationship with Laver Cup. Does anyone really think that Federer still wouldn't be scheduled for night sessions at the Australian Open? You know, the idea that the relationship with the Laver Cup is inappropriate, that's an airtight assertion. That is an unassailable assertion in my mind. It's absolutely correct. But the idea that it is in fact influencing the way the Australian Open schedules Federer, that seems to be off base, because the Australian Open was already giving Federer preferential court assignments before the Laver Cup even began and before that relationship even began. You know, all the focus should be toward how other players are treated, because that's what really shows how problematic this is. It creates the appearance that the Australian Open gives Federer preferential treatment that Federer deserves and Federer has earned, when it doesn't give the same preferential treatment to other people. You know, it wasn't so much about Federer versus Djokovic at the Australian Open. The bigger outrage from that Australian Open at the beginning of this year was that Halep and Caroline Wozniacki did not play the Australian Open women's final under a roof in conditions that were similarly hot and uncomfortable to the following day when Federer and Marin Cilic did play under a roof. You know, the temperature difference might have been 2 degrees, and the Australian Open said that, well, you know, the women's final didn't quite meet our temperature threshold or our heat index. That was a convenient excuse, you know, to justify leaving the roof open. But, you know, the weather conditions were manifestly uncomfortable there. And if people recall, Halep had to go to the hospital after that match to receive fluids and some degree of extra rest and replenishment. You know, if we had just made the common sense decision to put a roof over the Rod Laver Arena for that match, we wouldn't be talking as much about preferential treatment for Federer. It's really that this problem shows up not in what Federer gets, but what everybody else, or at least some other players, don't. And so that's why, Saqib, I go back to the point about let's at least to some degree take some decisions out of the hands of these organizers. And listeners at home might be wondering what that means or what it would look like. Here's an example. If you are a top four seed, let's just get you hypothetical. I'm not saying this has to be the reform or that this has to be the solution, but this is just kind of a generalized example to serve as kind of a template to form other people's thought processes. Let's say you're a top four seed. If you're a top four seed, you get a choice in one of the first, let's say, either three or four rounds. You get like maybe not a wild card, but like some kind of poker chip. You get the right to decide in one of those matches when and where you play as a reward for being a top four seed. So this would mean that, you know, let's say you are in the same half as Federer, the same half of the draw as Federer. So Federer is a two seed, you're a four seed. So you're both playing on the same day, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday during the first week and weekend of a major tournament. So Federer might get plum assignments for two matches, but then in the third round, if you're still there, you know, you could make the request, okay, I want my preferred court assignment on this day by virtue of being a top four seed. So that would be a small example of how a policy, if it was ever instituted, would take a decision out of the tournament's hands. It would create more incentives for players to achieve various seedings, various ATP rankings, and it would give players a certain degree of autonomy over their situation. So that would just be one example of limiting the extent to which tournaments can entirely dictate what players do. And I think if we can get to more of a democratic model like that in tennis, and you know, ideally with a players' union being the vehicle for implementing those kinds of changes, the nature of this discussion would significantly change. And if such a reformist philosophy could gain more and more traction over time, these debates would go away entirely.
Matt, I agree with the points you bring to the table, and I think we've always spoken about this topic, even offline in the DM or even email. And I'm not questioning, you know, I think this is a very fair way to look at things. But in the end, you know, it's a business, and like Roddick said, whoever's paying the bills is going to call the shots. Because if say somehow in 1 year Ivan Ljubicic was top four, there's no way Ivan Ljubicic will be getting a night match in Australian Open or US Open when, you know, the sponsors are paying and the local crowds are watching. They would want a Djokovic. They would want a Roddick. They wouldn't want a Federer. That's how it goes. And Ljubicic is fine, you know, like an example of Davidenko. I think there's certain players who just, you know, sell more in foreign markets, and there's certain players who work their way, you know, by creating their appeal. Even the great Ivan Lendl, you know, never got his due when he was playing. And, you know, there was always the Connors Mack era, and then Boris Becker was embraced by the Americans. Edberg was well liked. So, you know, you look at history, this is the first time this is happening. Yeah, is Federer the golden goose along with Nadal and Djokovic? These three guys have really taken tennis to a different, you know, stratosphere where they are in demand. They're like global superstars. It is what it is. I think what you're saying is, you know, ideal, and it's very fair play. I'm not questioning it. But at the same time, you know, when their sponsors coming in and each ad is slotted, I mean, there are people working for ESPN and BBC, you know, whose job is to analyze what the length of an ad should be and when it's injected. And a lot of times when, you know, you see in the tournaments, umpire calls time when the TV is back. So in an ideal world, what you're saying is not going to take place, because, I mean, I definitely respect, you know, the views, and we seldom disagree on this. in the podcast, but I don't see that ever materializing, even though if tennis becomes one big umbrella, one big mothership running, you know, everything in tennis, because, you know, Serena, Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Murray, these people have appeals that, you know, that transcends, you know, global audiences, and people are paying. It's, you know, commercials are airing during the 90-second, you know, tennis changeover. Yeah, I don't see that happening, Matt.
You know, I wouldn't predict that it's going to happen. I would only say that, you know, if what's happening with Gerard Piquet and what I will call the Piquet Cup, because it really isn't the Davis Cup anymore, you know, if this Piquet Cup continues to run into roadblocks, and if top players shut it out entirely, which I truly hope will happen, you could get some really nasty internal fights within the sport, and perhaps that turmoil could shake something up. But I would not bet on anything that I've said in terms of reforms. I would not bet on any of that happening, but that is certainly, in my mind, the path to clean up the sport and reduce its conflicts of interest. But yeah, if we're talking about, is this stuff going to happen anytime soon or even in our lifetimes? Yeah, I share your skepticism on that front.
All right. So I think on that note, we covered, you know, quite a lot today. So let's do this again in a week's time and discuss, you know, more pressing tennis topics, and hopefully there'll be a new topic, you know, that can be added to our conversation here.
Absolutely. And so as we sign off on this Tennis with an Accent podcast for this week, I want to remind our listeners on behalf of Saqib Ali that you can listen to the TWAA podcast on Google Play, Stitcher, with our friends at RadioInfluence.com. And we invite you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast at Apple Podcasts and iTunes. This is Matt Zemek for the Tennis with an Accent podcast. We'll see you next week.
Bye for now.
This is the Landry Football with Chris Landry. Quick fix on Radio Influence.
Clemson is definitely getting better. Definitely the team that looks most capable of challenging Alabama. They really are, after the BC win last week, which we thought they would get, not nearly going to get that challenge the rest of the way. South Carolina is a good team, rivalry game. But don't see that being something that's going to scare Clemson. And then the conference championship game, don't think that it's anyone's going to get Clemson. So looking pretty good there for the Tigers. And they are scoring a lot of points, and they're the one team that could maybe pressure the quarterback well enough. And I don't think their secondary is great, but it's good. And I think they can score points. It's the one team that looks like that they possibly could hang with Alabama on both sides of the ball. Beat them, I'm not sure, but hang with them, I think they can.
Chris Landry brings you Landry Football every week on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and, of course, RadioInfluence.com.